You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Jeff Goodell is the author of 7 books, and the most recent book that he wrote before this new one was The Water Will Come. It was about the problems and adaptations possible with the rising ocean level. His new book is The Heat Will Kill You First. Thank you for joining me, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
You write near the end of this book, "The strange thing is, my own awareness of the scope and scale of the climate crisis has made my life more vivid and paradoxically more meaningful." I think this is the key to the import of reading your books, because it'd be very easy to turn these into kind of nonfiction potboilers about doom and gloom. And you avoid that through wonderful storytelling. Talk about researching this book on heat after having researched a book on the ocean level rise. It must have been a challenge for you.
Yeah, it was a challenge, you know, and every time you finish a book as a writer, you think, okay, what's next? And, you know, some people, a friend of mine who's a writer, also who's a woman, compared it to childbirth. Like, I'm never going through that again, ever, ever, ever. And then, you know, time passes and you forget the pain and suffering, and you think, oh, maybe I'll have another one. And so, yeah, it was, you know, it's a big commitment to do a book. And so it's always hard to decide you're going in this direction. And for me, it was kind of clear. You know, I happened to be in Phoenix on a really hot day. In I think it was the summer of 2018, and I was going to a meeting, and I was late for my meeting, and my Uber was late, and so I decided I would like run 20 blocks downtown in Phoenix on a 115 degree day. Not a wise thing to do, but I just did it thoughtlessly. I just ran out the door of the hotel, and within 10 blocks or so, you know, my heart was pounding, I was feeling dizzy, you know, I'm in decent shape. And I realized, wow, you know, heat is dangerous. If I had to, you know, if I were out doing this much longer, I could be in real trouble. And it really was a kind of profound realization to me, because, you know, at that time, I've been writing about climate change for, you know, 20 years, and it had never occurred to me that, you know, a hotter planet could actually kill me in real time, that it was actually dangerous to me. And that was the birth of the book. And, you know, what was important about the book compared to The Water Will Come about sea level rise was, you know, sea level rise story is really important for all kinds of reasons that, you know, living in on the California coast, and presumably many of your readers know for all kinds of reasons, but it's not about human life, really. It's about how we live and where we live. But, you know, no one stands on the beach in Santa Cruz and drowns because a glacier melted, right? I mean, it doesn't happen in real time. It's this slow motion, long-term thing that has enormous consequences. Whereas heat is something that, as I say in the book, can kill you like a bug zapper. I mean, it's really not about infrastructure and about, you know, real estate values and, you know, water, although it's connected to things like drought. But it's really a story about humans and about living things and what it does to us and to all living things. So in that sense, it's very different from the Sea Level Rise book.
You know, it struck me that your books, which deal with both the present and the future, are a kind of hybrid of, both science writing and to a certain extent science fiction. And I think that the best way to explain this comes from William Gibson, a science fiction writer, who once said the future has already arrived. It's just not evenly distributed. And I think you are a man who goes to the places where it is not evenly distributed, finds the future, and then looks at the future that exists right now in the present.
That's a very thoughtful way to put it. And I've never thought about it that way. I've heard that quote before, but I think that's true. I think that's very like that describes my kind of reporting and narrative technique pretty succinctly. I really do want my books to be about the present moment. I think that a lot of writing and thinking about climate change and lots of things, but especially climate change is focused on the future and focused on what will happen, 50 years from now, and what will happen to future generations and to our grandchildren and things like that, which are all worthy things to think about. But they also make it feel like a distant event that may or may not happen, and that, we all have plenty of things to worry about in our lives and to think about. And so it's not exactly a way of framing what's going on in our world that is going to inspire either much action to do anything about it or even much interest to read a book about it. I really wanted to focus on what it means to us now, living here today in 2025. That's why I called this book The Heat Will Kill You First, which my publisher initially was not thrilled about.
I can understand that.
Yeah, they were like, no, Jeff, this is not the title, is going to be the title of your book. No one is going to buy a book called The Heat Will Kill You First. And I really argued for it because it really does embody this sort of direct connection to you right now that I really was at the sort of center of my thinking about the book. You and listeners can judge if it's a good title of the book or not, but I do think it's memorable, and I do think it does suggest what the sort of book is about and bring the story that I'm trying to tell into the here and now.
One of the things I think you do really well in this book is to give us characters and story narratives within the larger story. And for me, this connection of people's actual stories in the here and now is what really makes this book wonderful. Talk about finding these characters and boiling them down. I can imagine this might be an 800-page book with the number of people that you've talked to in the past.
Yeah. Well, that's partly my bias as a writer and what I'm personally interested in. I do not have a PhD in physics. When I was a young writer, I wanted to be a novelist. And so I am drawn to narrative and drawn to stories. That's how I make sense of the world. I've become very educated in science and climate science because of I've been reporting about this for 25 years. But my natural inclination is not to go find a really cool graph and reproduce it for you. My inclination is to go find a really interesting person, who is, in embodies something about what I want to write about. And let them tell the story, because I do think that storytelling is how we make sense of the world. I mean, that's how we made sense of the world, 5,000 years ago when we came back from, hunts and told the stories around the campfire about what happened and out on the hunt. And it's the same thing today. So I look for people. I have an idea of something that I want to write about. A situation, there's a story, for example, in The Heat Will Kill You First about a agricultural worker in Oregon who dies of extreme heat during working in the field. And I knew that I wanted to write about agricultural workers because I think that they're really important. They're out on the front lines. They're people that you don't really hear about in person very much. I spent some time doing some reporting, but then it just so happened in the midst of my reporting, I read a story about this man, named Sebastian Perez, who died in the field in Oregon during the summer when I was reporting this book. And I went up there and talked to some of his friends. I talked to his wife. I talked to his bosses. And I really tried to kind of recreate the sort of circumstances of his life and his death and to tell the story of what happened to him in the same way that, a novelist would tell it. And by telling the story, then interweaving the sort of issues of how working outdoors is dangerous and in extreme heat and labor laws that, don't require water and shade breaks and all kinds of things like that, to turn it into almost like a morality tale.
The last time we spoke, we were joined by Kim Stanley Robinson. And his book, I think at the time, was The Ministry for the Future. And that book opens with a heat dome settling over a unpowered, poor part of India and killing 1 million people. And I couldn't help but think of the perils that. As the heat dome was reported back in what 2023, I kept thinking about that book and thinking, oh my God, this could be the place where people start to get a clue. And then when I read your book, I was thinking the same thing. I thought, well, gosh, this is the kind of reporting that Stan wrote about essentially. So talk about the influence. Was this did Stan's book play a part in the way you structured your book?
I'm trying to remember because people bring up Stan's book a lot, and it's a really wonderful book, and it's an incredibly vivid chapter. And I had already started my book by the time I read his book. So his book did not, influence me to sort of write about that, but it certainly was something that I read while I was re thinking about the book and putting the book together. And it certainly made me think about, it certainly influenced the way I started the book off. I mean, I started the book off with a story of a family on a hike in California, outside of Yosemite, and this how they went for a hike early in the morning, youngish couple in their late 30s with a 1.5-year-old child and their dog. And, the family ends up being found dead, all of them on this trail. And it took, the sheriff's department basically a month and a half to figure out what happened to them before they came to the conclusion that it was extreme heat. In a certain way, that framing of that story in the opening was my kind of homage, if you will, to Stan in the way that I think that, these stories of that are dramatic like that of, sad stories of mortality are very gripping. And, I think that I chose to start with this couple because they were very much a kind of every person kind of people. They were not, we tend to think of people who are vulnerable to climate change as, poor people or brown people on the other side of the planet or whatever. They're not like us for many readers. And I really wanted to tell a story that showed that no, it is like us. It is us.
That was a really powerful story. I remember seeing that as it unfolded in the Chronicle and reading the articles about it. And I thought that you did a wonderful job in telling the story. And I think that's what happens in this book again and again, and that makes it so powerful are the stories. And it's interesting. One of the stories you tell towards the end is of a woman photographer. And I think in that chapter, you discussed not only her approach to trying to use art to and writing and journalism to take a picture of heat, which is invisible, but I think that's the challenges that you describe her facing are also the challenges that you yourself faced writing the book.
Exactly, exactly. And that's sort of why that fascinated me. You know, and she's a, the to just to clarify what you're talking about, she's a photographer who who's Pakistani and was on assignment for one of the British newspapers. It might have been The Guardian or The Independent. I forgot
The
which one.
Telegraph.
The Telegraph, right. And so she was on assignment in Pakistan for this story about extreme heat. Pakistan is one of the places that has been suffering from a sequence of really hot heat waves in the last years. And so the Telegraph was going to do a story, and she had the challenge of like, okay, how do I take a picture of this? And you know, one of the things, so it not only paralleled, you know, my challenge of, I've talked about this book as sort of like trying to write a biography of a ghost. You know, it's something that you can't see. I'm here in Austin, Texas right now, and I'm looking out my window, and you know, I can't tell if it's 70 degrees or 110 degrees outside by looking out the window, right? And so there's nothing visual about heat that tells you, signals anything to your brain that it's hot out there and you need to be careful, or that there's, it's risky, or whatever. It's very different than other extreme weather events, right? I mean, hurricanes, obviously, extreme rainfall, I mean, even drought and things like that, you know, there, you get visual signals. So she, you know, embodied that challenge, but also, you know, I also wanted to write about how poorly, what a poor job the media does in trying to communicate about climate change in general, but heat waves in particular, you know, because, you know, when you, in where I live in Texas, you know, we have like basically all summers an extreme heat wave. But whenever there's a, you know, a particularly hot event, you see on the front page of the paper or on websites or on local TV, you know, kids playing in sprinklers, or you know, lines of cars going to the beach, or things like that that really don't do anything to communicate the sort of human suffering that happens in during a heat wave. And so I really wanted to challenge that too. And she understood this, and she was determined to try to, you know, take a memorable photo in a way that communicated how dramatic this sort of human suffering was that she witnessed during this heat wave in Pakistan.
One of the things that you bring up is that we live in the Goldilocks zone. What do you mean by that? And that's a well-known term now. So how, what do you mean by that? And how is that changing?
So that's a really, you know, important idea that I'm glad you brought up. So it's the Goldilocks zone is a phrase that I stole from some astrophysicists here in Texas at University of Texas in Austin here, who I was talking to about their search for life, you know, outside of our solar system. And they use this term Goldilocks zone to talk about objects in space that might have the presence of liquid water. Liquid water is seen as a precursor to conditions for life, and it's fairly easily detectable even at, you know, these great cosmic distances. So if the planet's too cold, it's a block of ice, even if there is water. If the planet is too hot, of course, it's all evaporated and it's dry and there's nothing there. So they're looking for these planets in, or these objects, they're not planets necessarily, exoplanets, in space that are in what they call the Goldilocks zone. Not too hot, not too cold. And it's a useful phrase to think about why climate change in general and extreme heat in particular is such a risk, and why it's so important when we think about sort of the stability of human civilization. And that's simply that, you know, the last 12,000 years, 10,000 years or so, in which human civilization has really developed everything that we know of, from agriculture to obviously cities and things like that, have developed in this 10,000-year period where the temperatures have been very stable. We all know, and everybody who's ever tried to talk about climate change at a dinner party, has been challenged. Oh, there's temperatures of Earth have swung up and down. It's been cold, it's been hot. There have been alligators in on the North Pole. There's been palm trees in Antarctica. Yes, it's absolutely true that the planet has had wild swings of temperature driven by volcanic eruptions and other things. But we humans have developed in a very stable time. And what's happening now as we dump CO2 into the atmosphere, largely from the burning of fossil fuels, is that we're moving out of this Goldilocks zone very fast. We're heating up the planet much, much faster, 100 times faster than it ever has that we're aware of from natural processes. So what that means is that everything, including us humans, but everything that we have built, everything that we think of as civilization, is built to deal with this particularly narrow range of temperatures. And as we move out of that, it's a huge challenge for everything. And I mean, you can see it in the simplest ways with things like airport tarmacs, getting like pudding when it's too hot and planes can't land. And for that matter, they can't take off because it changes the lift under their wings, to things like, bridge structures cracking and stressing because the metal in the bridges are not designed for this kinds of extreme heat, to our own bodies, in that, we can tolerate a certain range of temperatures pretty well, but when it gets hotter than that, when it goes beyond that, we're in serious trouble, just like many other living things. And so we're poorly adapted to this radical rise of temperatures. And yes, there's air conditioning and things like that. We can talk about that. But this Goldilocks zone is a very fundamental idea, to kind of, I think it's when I give talks about my book, I always say that this is one of the two or three most important ideas I want people to come away from. If they understand nothing else about the sort of basics of kind of what I'm talking about in the book, this idea of the Goldilocks zone is one of the most important.
There's another concept too that is talked a lot about, especially in terms to heat waves, which is the wet bulb temperature. Talk about that and why that is so important as a good descriptor of the limits of when the humans can survive or not in a heat wave.
Yeah, that's a really important point. So maybe the best way to describe this is to start with the sort of realization that I think most people have experienced, which is that, if you're in 100-degree weather in the desert, say in Phoenix or something, or in the Mojave or wherever, it's very different than being in 100-degree weather in the Philippines or in Miami or for that matter here in Texas. The humidity makes it feel a lot hotter, right? Everyone, I think, recognizes this thing. So, and one of the ideas, one of the reasons is that, our bodies have one mechanism to deal with extreme heat, and that is sweat. And when our bodies start to overheat, our heart starts pumping blood out towards the surface of our skin. We have these little like windshield wiper squirters, pores all over our bodies that squirt water onto the surface of our skin. That when that water evaporates, through evapotranspiration, it takes the heat away and cools the blood under the surface of the skin. That blood recycles and makes our and cools off our bodies. So when it's more humid, though, the sweat doesn't evaporate as well. And when it's very humid, it doesn't evaporate at all, so that our natural cooling mechanism doesn't work. So this wet bulb temperature is an attempt to try to measure the conditions that our bodies are actually experiencing in any given situation, rather than just the air temperature, right? So air temperature, if someone says it's 100 degrees outside, well, okay, then we know that, when you go out there's other factors also that influence how we feel it. Humidity is one of them. So we often have on the news and other things, this feels like temperature, right? And that's an attempt to be a little bit more accurate, and it'll be a combination of the air temperature and the humidity. But the wet bulb globe temperature is an attempt to go further than that. It was developed by the military because they are very concerned about troops and how they can deal with extreme situations and things. And it looks at all the things that we attempts to mimic what we really feel. So it measures sunlight, it measures wind, it measures humidity, it measures air temperature. It's a much more kind of holistic measurement of what we're actually experiencing. And scientists who look at what our body temperature can deal with have determined that basically there are, wet bulb temperature limits that our bodies, even if you're at rest, can't function in any, higher temperature. It's about 35 C, which is about 92 degrees, 93 degrees, wet bulb globe temperature. That if you're in that for too long, your body cannot cool off, and basically you will die. So it's basically an attempt to have a much more accurate measurement of the kind of effects of temperatures on our bodies.
The effects of temperatures on our bodies are one thing, but also the effects of temperatures on the creatures around us are another, with respect to especially the most important, the most horrific creature that inhabits us, this earth, that has killed more than anyone and thing else, is Aedes aegypti, mosquito.
Yes, most terrifying creature, absolutely. I'm glad you put it that way because everyone, when they think of terrifying creatures, they think of sharks, they think of, lions or whatever. But it's absolutely true that mosquitoes have killed far more people over time than any other animal. And so I talk about mosquitoes a lot in my book because, for a couple of reasons. One is that they are exquisitely kind of well adapted or sensitive to heat. And they move around. They're obviously very mobile. And so their range is incredibly sensitive to changes in heat, to a certain, it can't be, they have their Goldilocks zone too. It can't be too cold, can't be too hot. And as their range moves, they move with it. And the problem is that mosquitoes carry a lot of things with them that we don't like and that are not good for humans. Pathogens that cause diseases, malaria, Zika, dengue fever, things like that. And these, what are called vector-borne diseases, are carried by these animals that are exquisitely sensitive to changes in temperature. So the implications of this are enormous. So one of the things I talk about in the book a little bit is the shifting of the malaria range in sub-Saharan Africa. In sub-Saharan Africa, 400,000 people a year or so die from malaria. And the people who are vulnerable, it's changing because the mosquitoes are moving with their Goldilocks zone, so it has enormous implications for people there. Mexico City is a great example. Also, it was always a place that was cool enough that it didn't have mosquitoes at all. It was beyond their range. It's a high city, and it was always cool enough. Well, now it's getting warm enough that it's moving into the mosquitoes' Goldilocks zone, and now they're starting to see Zika and dengue fever and all these other diseases in a place like Mexico City. And it also, interestingly, has an impact on wildlife. I was just in Hawaii last week doing some reporting for a new book, and I went out looking for this very some of the native birds from Hawaii. I was on Maui. And there aren't that many left. And the reason there aren't that many left is because of avian malaria, which is carried by mosquitoes. and it has decimated the native birds of Hawaii. But they there is a thin band at about 8,000 feet on the slopes of the volcanoes there, where these birds have retreated. That is too cold still for the mosquitoes, and so you have this thin band of native Hawaiian birds that are thriving. But as it continues to warm up, that band will keep moving higher and higher, and they don't have much higher that they can go, and they will soon, be extinct. But it's a great example of the consequences of these changing gradients of temperature.
One way humans can avoid the high temperature is air conditioning. And you tell a great story of Harold Goodman. And I love your sensibility in this story because he's such an everyman and he affected such an enormous change in our civilization. But air conditioning is maybe not exactly the answer we need.
Yeah. So one footnote to that story, which goes to one of your earlier questions about how do I find people that I write about and things. So I, in doing this book, I knew I was going to write about air conditioning, of course, and that's a really important part of this story. But I didn't like really, I was reading books and, poking around, but I didn't really know how I was going to do it. And then one day I went out for coffee with a friend here in Austin, and he brought along another friend, a woman who was in her 60s. And we're just talking about, I don't know what we were talking about, but it wasn't about my book or anything. And somehow my book came up, and I said, I'm writing a book about heat. And the woman said, oh, my dad, was in air conditioning. He built an air conditioning business. And I'm like, oh, really? What did he do? And then she started to tell me, and it turns out that it was him. I mean, that she told me enough about his story that I became interested in it. And the more I learned about him, the more fascinating it became. And that became the spine of that chapter. And I don't think he'd ever been written about before. There was no press about him at all. So this was a story that came out of, my having coffee with somebody in Austin and talking about her father. And her father turned out to be a fascinating figure. And that's how it works sometimes. You just sort of fall into these things. But as far as air conditioning, air conditioning is something that comes up all the time whenever I talk about my book, and rightfully so. There's this unspoken and sometimes loudly spoken response to my book, which is like, yeah, okay, I understand that heat is a problem and the world's getting hotter and all that, but we have air conditioning. Why don't we just get everybody air conditioning? It's okay. We'll fix it. We have a fix for this, right? And it's like, it's such an American like techno fix. We have a problem, we have a machine that'll deal with it, kind of a response to this problem of extreme heat and climate change. And so, I mean, I'm fascinated by air conditioning, and I could spend the rest of this interview talking about it. But the short version of it is that yes, air conditioning is really important. I live in Austin, and I thought as an experiment I would try to write my book without air conditioning. Did not work. There was not this book was not going to get written without being able to retreat to air conditioning. So I personally understand the value and virtue of it. Much of the southern United States, Florida, Texas, places like this would not be set, civilized or settled in the way that they are, developed in the way they are without air conditioning. It's an incredibly important tool that saves lives. All that I totally get. But it's also true that, 750 million people on this planet don't even have access to electricity, much less air conditioning. So, when you even begin to talk about air conditioning, you're talking in a kind of privileged bubble that is not shared with much of the world. Furthermore, when you think about the problems of heat and all the things that I write about in my book, it's not just about, our being able to survive in a room. It's also about the food that we grow. It's also about, the wildlife, fisheries, all that kind of thing. And, we're not going to air condition the fields where our crops grow. We're not going to air condition the oceans. We're not going to air condition the forests. We're not going to air condition the, ice sheets that are melting and all of that. So it's a bubble that, the relatively wealthy and privileged have been able to sort of build for themselves. That certainly is helpful, but it's also kind of delusionary in the sense that it keeps us from seeing the real scale of the problem. And just to add to that, of course, air conditioning requires electricity. And so as we add more air conditioning, we're going to add more demand for power. And if that power does not come from clean, renewable energy, then we're going to add to emissions. And that just creates this sort of, endless feedback loop that is going to heat the planet up more and more. And then finally, the last thing about it, which fascinates me and I write about in the book, is that, a city like Austin, where I live, or Phoenix, or many other cities in the Southwest or the South, where they're almost 100% air conditioned. The way we live here and the way we build our buildings are very dependent upon it. It drives me nuts when I go to hotels and I can't open the window, right? Because they don't want you to open the window because everything is air conditioned, everything is sealed. And there's certainly some gains of efficiency and things around that. But the problem is that if the air conditioning goes out, those buildings do not work anymore. And I write about it in my book about some studies that have been done by some urban planners and things that about what would happen, for example, if in a city like Phoenix, there was a 3-day blackout. We had a 5-day blackout here in Austin in the winter. 3-day blackout is not beyond the pale at all. And it turns out that the consequences would be, enormous. There would be 18,000 people in the emergency room. No, I'm sorry, 18,000 deaths in Phoenix in 3 days as a result of this. There would be like 300,000 people visiting emergency rooms because of overheating and heat-related problems. It's like a air conditioning is like a sword of Damocles hanging over these cities that are so dependent upon them. And so, it's the story of air conditioning is a very complex story that involves progress and money and a kind of forgetting about how to build buildings and live lives that are not dependent on these mechanical machines.
More lifeboats will not stop the Titanic from sinking.
Exactly.
One of the things I really liked about your book was the way that you interweave stories and tell stories. And I think that in the end, you talk about naming heat waves and the problems around that. Talk about trying to turn this story of a ghost into a story of, essentially, you're converting a ghost story to a serial killer story.
Yeah, I mean, I thought a lot about that, about how to make this thing tangible, right? And so that's one of the reasons why I focused on characters so much, people, because this is ultimately a real human story, much more, as I mentioned, than the Sea Level Rise book. So I knew that I needed to do that. Oddly, one of the things that inspired me in how I thought about this book, because each chapter of the book kind of takes a different has a different subject. They're all about heat in different ways. But one chapter is about kind of stories about what it does to your body. And one chapter, there's a chapter about air conditioning. There's a chapter about a trip I took to the Arctic and implications with heat on ice, and in my case, a polar bear. There's the what it does with the spread of disease and things like that. We talked about that with mosquitoes. But each chapter has this different lens of looking at the same thing. And that structure came to me as a result of one of my favorite poems, which is Wallace Stevens' poem, 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird. And he writes about a blackbird from just all these different perspectives and different ways of seeing this ordinary creature like a blackbird. And I sort of thought about it that way, of describing this ghost from 13 or however many chapters I have, I don't remember now, different perspectives. And maybe if we saw it from all these different angles, we would have a better understanding of the thing itself.
One of the things that reading this book, I think that's really interesting is you have individual reactions, and you realize that I may have an individual reaction to what you are writing in a more general sense, and I'm thinking too now about the blob, and also too about the rise in sea temperatures, because as a kid, I saw any number of mildly scary movies when I was a kid. And the movie that really, really terrorized me was Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds. Because in that movie, it's Mother Nature that's against you, that there's nobody you can fight, there's nowhere you can run. So when I read about the sea temperatures in Florida getting up to 85 degrees and bleaching the corals, I'm just thinking, we are done.
Well, yes, of course, corals are something very near to my heart. But I want to say something about it's funny that you bring up Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, because that was the first movie that I remember also being kind of terrified. And I saw it in a drive-in in Mountain View, California, with my parents. And I just remember, and because Hitchcock spent so much time in the Bay Area and was sort of a,
Lived in Scotts Valley. And actually, The Birds was based on an incident that happened in Rio Del Mar, where I live, when the seagulls ate some, a red tide and got
Oh, really?
gotten drunk. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew he lived in Scotts Valley because I remember when we would drive through there, my parents would say that. But he felt like a local guy to me in some way. And he was on, the Alfred Hitchcock Hour and all that kind of stuff, which I would see sometimes. And so that made the movie even more terrifying to me. The fact that it was sort of this person that I didn't know but was familiar to me made this movie that was so kind of deeply terrifying about the sort of mystery of nature. And that movie's about many things, but it's also about the sort of presumption of sort of human superiority, right? That there's forces and intelligences far beyond what we can kind of grasp. It's one of the things that I took from it when I was a kid. But anyway, so you brought up the ocean, and one of the hard parts about reporting a book like this is, and this goes to a little bit to the thing that you talked about in the very opening of this conversation, which is about how I felt like reporting this book made the world more vivid to me. And the Great Barrier Reef and corals are is a great example of that to me. I have been to I've done a lot of diving. I've been to a number of reefs, and the Great Barrier Reef, I brought my then 13-year-old daughter to. I write about that a little bit in the book, because I wanted her to see it before it's gone. To me, these ancient living structures that are so complex and the incredible strangeness of the life of corals and make these things some of the most wonderful and mysterious living organisms on the planet to me. And the fact that they're being so devastated by this rising of in sea temperatures, and of all of the living things that we know are at risk from higher temperatures, coral reefs are by far the, they're goners. I mean, they're just goners. And it will take very, very long time for them to grow back, tens of thousands of years if and when the sea temperatures, recede. So to me, they're very moving and very much, they're one of the things that I wanted to look most closely at, and that I feel like writing this book and thinking about them in this way made me see them more clearly. When I was at the Barrier Reef with my daughter, I really paid attention. I looked at this in a way that I don't think I would have looked at if I didn't understand. It's like the last time if you have a friend who has a illness, cancer or something. This has happened to me, and you know that they're not long for the world. And you see them, may or may not be the last time. You pay attention to them, you say things to them, you look at them in the eye, and you imprint it in your mind because you know that you may or may not see that person again. And that's how I felt with the Barrier Reef, and with corals in general. And it's a terrible thing, but it's also kind of wonderful and beautiful. And I'm really grateful that my understanding of what's happening in the world gave me the privilege of looking in that way.
You took your daughter in our local area here in the Mont diving in the Monterey Bay, and it was interesting. Again, that's where the power of this book is. It will, no matter where you live or what you do, whether it's in Pakistan in the midst of a terrible heat wave, or here in Monterey Bay looking at the world from underneath the ocean at the kelp beds, that you will become personally involved in this book. And that's one of the things that's wonderful. And I have to say that the Water Will Rise had a hopeful tone to it. It would, it said, well, when it comes up, humans are good at adapting, and this is the kind of thing we can adapt to. Let's sell with the heat.
That's a really good point. And just to geolocate the dive I did, it was Monastery Beach in Monterey Bay where my daughter and I dove. It was so spectacular. It was just unbelievable how wonderful it was. That was one of the great diving experiences of my life, taking her there in those kelp beds. So it is very different than, thinking about sea level rise, right? This is I was more personally involved in this book, partly because it's a book about mortality. It's a book about life and death, for us, for other creatures. The Sea Level Rise book is not. It's a book about how we live, and it's a book about how we are attached to things that we love and don't want to give up. Endless I've met many people who have places that are highly at risk, whether it's on the Outer Banks or whether it's at Imperial Beach in Southern California or wherever, who know their homes are at risk and get floods all the time but don't want to leave. And there's a lot of kind of policy related questions about, how insurance works, how we develop policies to encourage people to move away from risky areas. There's a lot of big picture consequences to sea level rise. You see it there in Santa Cruz, right, with increasing erosion along the coast, and the pier just getting washed away, and
I imagine that my granddaughter will one day look and say that my grandfather used to walk his dogs on that when it was a beach still instead of underwater. And it's
so
not
so
that far away.
so so I think, thinking about sea level rise really forces you to think about time and space in a different way, because one of the big ideas in that book is that We as humans have built our world with the assumption, that the water is here and the ground is there and the shore is there, and forever it has been that way and forever it shall be. Whereas they're all just temporary arrangements, right? And Miami Beach, which I write about a lot in the book, has that barrier island that Miami Beach is built on has been there maybe 7,000 years, which is nothing in geologic time, right? And these beaches are moving all the time. And I just saw that again in Hawaii at Waikiki Beach. And there's all this effort at sand replenishment and building seawalls and all that. But it's like this sort of war against nature kind of thing, and this assumption that we that we can defeat water, that we can build battlements and elevate buildings and do all these things that will allow us to continue living the way we always have. And of course we can't. And as one character in that book says, never fight a war with water because water always wins. And it's true. But that's a very different story than the story that I'm telling in the Heat book.
What are you working on now?
Well, I'm just getting started on another book. And it's a very, I'm hesitant to talk much about it because it's so unformed yet. But I'm really interested in accountability, and like what is so we know that burning fossil fuels and everything is what's caused this problem. We have these fossil fuel companies that have profited hugely off of it. They're how is the sort of you broke it, you fix it idea, and so there's a lot of talk right now, a lot of controversy about some various kinds of lawsuits about towards these fossil fuel companies or not. There's
And
this,
that's covered in this book.
with Freddie Otto and the so this new scientist.
I love those characters. Freddie Otto is great.
Yeah, she I just talked to her this morning, in fact, for something else. So she's fantastic. So actually it was that chapter, when I went around, I've been all around the world on book tour for this book, and whether I'm in India or in Australia or in Singapore, that chapter and that idea of the work that she does, which just to be clear is this thing called climate attribution, where she's a scientist who's looking at impacts of extreme weather events. Like in the book, I use the example of the heat wave that hit the Pacific Northwest in 2021. And basically, long story short, she's able to use a bunch of modeling and other science to say that that heat wave could not have happened and would not have happened without global warming, without climate change, without higher levels of CO2 in the atmosphere. So she's, beginning to test this, bring up these questions about who is responsible, really. And it changes the dynamic in a big way, because before, when someone would ask a scientist, did climate change cause this hurricane or this heat wave or this wildfire or whatever, the scientist would quote some version of what, NASA scientist, kind of godfather of climate change scientist, James Hansen would say, which is, well, we can't say that it caused that event, but it loads the dice. It makes it more likely. Well, Freddie's work and the work of others are able to say, no, this was caused by that. And once you get into that kind of causation stuff, it brings up a lot of questions about responsibility and things like that. So I'm basically exploring the outgrowth of her work, and basically how to maybe expand that chapter into a kind of sequel.
The new book by Jeff Goodell is The Heat Will Kill You First. Thank you for joining me, Jeff. This has been a delight.
Now, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Happy to be here.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.